Okay, so unfortunately we don't have sh slides, but we'll do a little bit of chanting. Some of you know that, just refuge and bodhicitta. We do it in English, yeah, and the Four Immeasurables. And then we'll have a few minutes of watching our breath, cultivating our motivation, and then we'll have the talk. And then questions. And maybe answers. So, in order to practice the Dharma, we need teachers. And we seek teachers because we need a Dharma education. We need guidance along the path. But why are we practicing the path to start with? Is it just for to feel better in this life, have better relationships with people? Is it to create some virtues so we have a good future rebirth? Is it because we want to get ourselves out of samsara and become an arhat? All of those are reasonable motivations. But as Mahayana practitioners, our motivation is much broader, and we seek to attain full awakening so that we could be of the greatest benefit to each and every sentient being. So let's place what we're doing today very squarely within that view of working for the benefit of all beings and having to tame our afflictions and even free ourselves of the cognitive obscurations so that we can attain Buddhahood and do that. So let's make that our motivation for sharing the Dharma today. So, our topic today is how to rely on a spiritual mentor. So, what I say is going to be from how His Holiness the Dalai Lama teaches this topic. Okay? And I'm going to talk about it in a more modern way or a way that pertains more to what is happening in the Buddhist world nowadays. So I may speak about some of the things to look out for also. Okay. But to start with, why do we need a spiritual mentor? Okay. And first of all, before I even get into that, because the usual translation of the topic is guru devotion. That is a wrong translation and it's very misleading. Okay? When you say guru, you think of, oh, wow, somebody who's, up on some cloud in meditation, completely awakened. And devotion, we think, oh, I just lay myself on the ground. I'm totally devoted. Yes, whatever you say, I'm going to do. And that isn't the way to rely on a spiritual mentor. Okay? Lama Tenpa. Yeah, Lama means spiritual mentor. Tenpa means to rely on. So how to rely on a spiritual mentor. Yeah. How to create a good relationship with a spiritual mentor so that they can guide you. Yeah. Because we need to make ourselves guidable. Okay. If there's some qualifications we have to have in order to really make the relationship with spiritual mentors worthwhile. Okay, but first of all, why do we need a spiritual mentor? Well, we came out of the womb not knowing anything, right? Except how to cry. And a little, then we learned how to smile, which got us more food. Okay, but everything else we know in our life is because other people taught us. Yeah, we didn't come out of the womb knowing how to speak. Yeah, knowing how to behave properly. We didn't know anything, but we needed people to teach us. Yeah, so even to talk, yeah, even to read and write, skills that we use every day that we couldn't function in society without, we need people to teach us. So for a topic as delicate as attaining awakening, we certainly need teachers and guides who can show us the proper way to go about doing it. And I say this because there's some people who really like to make up their own path. Yeah, they're creative. It's my creativity. Yes. So I like, what do I like from Buddhism? I like all the colors in the paintings. Yeah, they're so beautiful. And I like ceremonies, you know, that especially Tibetans, short horns, long horns, boom, deep chanting, oh, you know, big drums. Yeah, boom, boom, boom. Yeah, small drums. Yeah, everything. And brocade. Oh boy, Tibetan Buddhists have a lot of brocade. And they have small thrones and big thrones. Yeah, I want somebody who sits on a big throne with lots of brocade. And hats. Yeah, the Tibetans are great. Yellow hat. Red hat, black hat. At Srivasti Abbey, we are the sun hat sanctuary. Okay. So we get easily enchanted by these external things, but they are not the Dharma. And we're not going to learn the path to enlightenment from all these things. You know, how to make tormas, how to, you know, how to hold your kata properly, how to remember to bring a kata, dun, dun, dun. You know, so, you know, the teacher is to teach us the path, okay? And not only to teach us, but to guide us. And so when you have a close relationship with your teacher, then the teacher will observe how you act. And when you act inappropriately, they will say something to you. Yeah. Yeah, something. And we all say, oh, yes, please correct me when I make a mistake. As soon as your teacher does, see, saying that to me for? Yeah. Well, I made a mistake. Yeah, I'm not being very mindful of the precepts. I'm not being mindful of the etiquette. So we need somebody who's going to correct us, because otherwise we're just going to go through life like, and go through Dharma practice like a bull in a china shop. Yeah, I'm just wrecking everything. Okay, so it's important to have teachers. In Tibetan Buddhism, it's fine to have more than one teacher, and you may rely on different teachers for different things. Yeah, you may have, for example, His Holiness Dalai Lama. I suspect he's the teacher of many of us here. Do you get to go talk to him personally? No. Okay. He has thousands of students. So we may not have a personal connection where he knows our name and so on. But we go to the teachings, and when His Holiness teaches, you will never hear another teacher like that. I mean, he's so incredible. So he's one of our teachers. Yeah. Then you may have other teachers who don't have, you know, thousands of students, who when you have some challenge in your practice, you can go and ask them questions, and they'll counsel you. Yeah. You may have some teachers that excel in teaching you different topics. So you may go to them for those different topics. Okay. But we have to choose appropriate teachers for everything, because nowadays, not everybody who is a teacher really fits the bill. Okay. We have, I don't know about here, but especially in my country, but I think also here, you have some people. His Holiness says that in India, they're nobody, but they come to another country. All of a sudden, you know, they are, you know, venerable, His Eminence, Lama, Guru, so-and-so, you know, the third Rinpoche of something, something, something. Yeah. So all of a sudden, he doesn't just have his name like in India, but a whole string of titles. Yeah. Where did the titles come from? Very often they give them to themselves. Yeah. People who give themselves titles, I don't know about you, but I'm skeptical of that. Yeah. Because, you know, when I observe the people who I consider real teachers, one quality they have is that they're very, very humble. Okay. They're very humble. And I'll give you an example. When I lived in Italy, we invited Geshe Heshi Thobten to come and teach. He was one of the meditators in the huts above Dharamsala. I know some of you have been to Dharamsala and seen high on the mountain. And he didn't want to teach. He wanted to continue retreat. He had been doing retreat for many years. But His Holiness asked him to go to Italy. So Geshe-la did what his teacher asked him to do. When he came to Italy, yeah, we had just fixed up this villetta, this little cottage, china dishes, silverware, everything's new and beautiful. We made his throne in the Gompa, big throne, you know, with some brocade and a nice cushion and a back cushion and everything. Because, you know, we wanted to show our respect to him. Well, you know, when we offered Geshe-la his first food, his first meal on china plates with silverware, he looked at it and he said, "Take these plates away. Take these knives and forks away. Just give me plastic plates." Okay, just give me ordinary forks and spoons, no silver. Okay, when he went into the Gompa to teach, he looked at the throne, looked at the brocade, he took the cushion off the top of the throne, threw it on the floor, and sat down. No high thrones for him. Yeah. I knew him before when he was in Dharamsala. Yeah. He was old. Yeah. And he had whiskers. It wasn't a beard. It was just whiskers, you know, sticking out. And his shemdap was a little bit short. It was, his socks usually fell down. Sometimes his shemdap had some dirt on it. He lived up in the mountains. There's no washing machine. And he just, did his korwa around the main temple, just, very, very smoothly, very humbly. And so that kind of thing to me was a big signal of, humility. One time, there was a science conference. This was some years ago. And the scientists came, and there was one scientist who knew His Holiness from a previous scientific conference. So when we go in the room, this one scientist goes, "Oh, Dalai Lama, what is it like? He can say Dalai Lama." He said, "Dalai Lama," and went and gave His Holiness a big hug. I'm like, this is not what you do, Just Dalai Lama, like you're seeing your old friend. And, His Holiness, totally cool about it. Nothing, His Holiness didn't care that this guy wasn't keeping proper etiquette. So this kind of thing is, to me, really means a lot because they tell us to look at our teachers or possible teachers' behavior. In other words, and His Holiness says this a lot, do not look just at titles. Don't titles, here in the West, we look at titles. If you have a lot of letters after your name in the West, MS, PhD, blah, 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 JD, oh, well, you must be highly educated. So Lisa says, no, that's not it. It's not the titles. It's the wisdom, it's the compassion. And so look at, first of all, how the teacher behaves. Do they keep their precepts well? Or do they just kind of, well, yeah, I have precepts, but there's an exception to this, an exception to that, and I take all the exceptions, No, you want somebody who has good ethical conduct, who's not going around and sleeping with their students, propositioning their students, embezzling money from the Dharma Center. You want to look and see how their ethical conduct is. Then you want to see about their meditative ability. Do they meditate? Do they have experience in meditation? Can they guide you in your meditation? And you want to check their wisdom. Do they know the right view of emptiness? Because if they don't, and they're just making up their own dharma, then that's what they're going to teach you, and you're going to learn the wrong view. And if you practice the wrong view, you're going down the slippery slope. So people who make up their own teachings, it's something to be careful of because often you find people who, they like, I like, like I said, the paintings from the Tibetan tradition. And I have this great mindfulness app. The music in my mindfulness app is just the music I like. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Perky music to practice silent mindfulness with an app for only $99.99, special deal for you this week. And this teacher really likes food. More food. And the offering bowl Yeah, you've seen those, you know, it looks like a gong. And it was originally created as a gong, one of those big gongs. But it says offerings, dana, you know. In other words, this is what you're supposed to do. Yeah, win some favor with the teacher. Okay. And then, or teachers, and I say this because this has happened, who say, I'm raising money for my monastery in Tibet. Please make donations. We're building a monastery in Tibet. I'll bring pictures next year when I come. Well, next year when they come, oh, I forgot the pictures. I'll bring them next year. But here, you can give more money to help build them up. Next year they come again and, oh, our camera was broken. We couldn't take pictures. Yeah. And then you find out that the money wasn't going to the monastery like they said. It was, our robes don't have pockets, but it looks like some people's have pockets. Yeah. Okay. I heard another case where the teacher was saying, you know, my family needs money, collecting money, you know, sending it back to their family. And one woman, you know, was very sympathetic. She gave a donation. Then he asked for more, and she gave another donation. The next year, asked for more. And pretty soon, she didn't have enough money for her family. So this kind of thing is not proper conduct. I mean, that's not the kind of teacher you want. Okay, so you want a teacher who knows the Dharma, and you want a teacher who is teaching with a proper Dharma motivation. Okay, so somebody who has ethical conduct, who respects the Dharma, who cherishes the Dharma, who wants to see the Dharma exist in our world forever so that sentient beings can benefit from it. Yeah. You want a teacher who is very patient, who has a lot of fortitude, because sometimes we disciples don't act so well. Sometimes we're a little bit obnoxious. What do you think? Yeah. Do you admit that sometimes you're obnoxious? Oh, you people do. These two don't. So you need a teacher who is very patient and doesn't just fly off the handle when you know, do something really dumb and say, get out of here, you know. Yeah, I can't teach you anything. Just get out, you know. You want a teacher who knows that you're going to make mistakes, who knows that sometimes you're going to be obnoxious, but not too obnoxious, you know, and who will continue to teach you despite all of that, okay? You want a teacher who has lots of compassion so that, you know, when you are sick, they have compassion. When you are confused, yeah, when you hit a bump in the road and you don't know how to practice, or you're, you know, going, oh, my practice is getting nowhere. I can't practice the Dharma. You know, somebody who has compassion and who will give you good advice, you know, what to do. Okay. So, yeah. And you want somebody, at least in the Tibetan tradition, who has a good relationship with His Holiness. Yeah. Because there's one group that criticizes His Holiness. You don't want to get involved there. Okay. So there's different kinds of gurus or different kinds of spiritual mentors. Yeah. And in the Tibetan tradition, some teachers teach right from the very get-go, the guru is the Buddha. Okay? The guru is the Buddha. You have samaya. You've got to do everything the guru says exactly like that, or you're going to hell. Yeah. And wait a minute, I haven't signed up for that. Well, there's some problems here. One problem is that we took highest yoga tantra initiation prematurely, yeah, without having a proper basis. But another problem is that there's different ways of relating to different kinds of spiritual mentors according to what they're teaching you. And there's different ways of seeing them according to what they're teaching. So at the initial level, when we come into the Dharma, yeah, we need to learn the Lamrim. We need to learn the Four Noble Truths. Yeah. We need to learn the five precepts and take the five precepts and take refuge. You know, that's what we need to do at the beginning to establish a good foundation. Yeah. So the teacher who teaches us those things, although we might say they're things for beginners, that doesn't mean that they're simple. Okay? It doesn't mean they're simple. But these teachers are very, very important for us. Yeah. And how do we see them? We see them as representatives of the Buddha, not as the Buddha, but as representatives. Because when they give you refuge, when they give you precepts, they're, you know, Shakyamuni Buddha isn't here. So they are representing Shakyamuni Buddha and giving you refuge and precepts. Yeah. And getting you going, knowing the Buddhist worldview and the fundamentals of the path. Okay. Then the next level of teacher, is the teacher that teaches you about bodhicitta and teaches you about the bodhisattva path. Yeah, how to generate bodhicitta, how to practice the six perfections. Yeah. And this is quite important, you know. And this teacher, you know, is, yeah, not all teachers can do that. Yeah. And so this teacher, you see, not just as a representative of the Buddha, but as an emanation of the Buddha. Not as a Buddha, but as the emanation of a Buddha, because they're teaching you the bodhisattva path to Buddhahood. Okay? Then, yeah, the next level you practice is Tantrayana. Yeah? And within Tantra, there's different levels of practice. When you get to the highest level of practice, yeah, Mahānuttara Yoga Tantra, highest yoga tantra. That teacher, what they do is they give you the empowerment, yeah, to connect you with a particular deity, and they give you the Jhanam. The empowerment is called Wang. The Jhanam is called a permissory right, because they're giving you permission, you know, to see the deity, yeah, and make a connection. So that teacher of the highest yoga tantra, that's the one where it says in the text that you see that teacher as the Buddha. Okay? Now, What does it mean to see the teacher as the Buddha? Does that mean when you see the teacher walking down the street, you instantly bow to them, right outside in the in the alleyway and on the sidewalk? Oh, I saw the Buddha. No, it doesn't mean that. Yeah. It means that in the highest yoga tantra, one of the big practices is to create pure appearance, pure view. Yeah. And so you practice seeing all the living beings around you as Buddhas. Okay. This is a technique that helps us not get so mad at people or bugs, because if you see them as Buddhas, you're a little bit more tolerant of different things, and you think, they're talking too loud in a public place. You think, oh, if they're doing something, that's not so good, they're teaching me what I look like when I do that. So you don't criticize them. Okay? So we're trying to see sentient beings as Buddhas, and that helps us have more compassion, be more tolerant, and so on. Okay? Yeah. But when we hear that the guru is the Buddha, and we hear that you have to do everything the Buddha says, then it becomes kind of weird how people act. Okay? I know this from experience. So, for example, everybody wants to serve the teacher, the guru, who's the Buddha. Yeah? So he just said he wanted a cup of tea. Okay, everybody get out of the kitchen. I am making the cup of tea. I don't care if you're the cook. I don't care if you're the tea maker. Get out of here. He asked me for a cup of tea. I am going to make the cup of tea and offer it to him because I want the merit. Yeah, you're going to get along great with all the other disciples, aren't you? Yeah? And what I see happens in Dharma centers, yes, everybody wants to serve the teachers. And when you go, they go in so kind, so humble, serve the teacher the meal, invite the teacher to come and teach. Yeah. Yeah. Wash the teacher's dishes. They're so happy because this teacher is the Buddha. And I create so much merit when I wash the Buddha's dishes. Yeah. But the Dharma Center also needs people to help wash the dishes of all the people who are attending the teachings. That person, no, I'm not going to wash those dishes. Yeah? They can wash their own dishes. I'm busy serving the guru. Yeah. Yeah, that person is really going to get along very well with the other disciples. You also hear, even the guru's family you should respect. Even the guru's pets you should respect. Yeah. I used to chant one Maitreya prayer to my teacher's dogs every evening. Yeah. I wanted to create merit, chanting to the dog. The dogs came to the teachings even. Yeah. They were so cute. Yes, one of the dogs could sit in my lap. The other one could sit behind me. No problem. Okay. But another student who puts their cushion too close to mine, what are you doing? Move, get away from here. Yeah, give me some space. And I'm not going to wash your dishes, and I'm not going to move my cushion so that you are more comfortable. Yeah, because you think the guru's dog is more important than the guru's disciples. Ding dong. Yeah, think. Yeah, use your wisdom. Sometimes we relate to the guru like, you know, oh, they know everything. So where do I renew my visa? Yeah, he's supposed to know which visa office to go to renew it. Okay. One of my friends, he lived in Dharamsala, and he was having the landlord of the place where he was living. There were some difficulties. So he went to Serkam Rinpoche, his teacher, and said, Rinpoche, what do I do? I'm having problems with the landlord. Yeah, like Rinpoche's supposed to know. Rinpoche looked at him and said, go ask a lawyer. Yeah. In other words, yeah, you don't, although we may see the guru as the Buddha, we shouldn't expect our teachers to know everything. Okay? One person told me, this one cracked me up, that they were had to drive the teacher somewhere. And they assumed that because he was the Buddha, he knew the directions how to get there. No. Oh dear, then he must not be the Buddha. Yeah. Another person, another person said, my gurus think that men are superior to women. Do I have to believe that because that's what my teacher believes? What do you think? Oh, some of you aren't sure. Some of the men are saying, yes, he's right. Yeah. The women are saying, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Yeah. No. Yeah. Did you come to, another one. Another one is, this happened. I'm telling you things that happened. I'm not making things up. And this was in the U.S., and one of our teachers, this was several years ago, it was way before Trump, so, but he wanted to vote. Our teacher really liked George W. Bush. Why? Because George Bush supported Tibetan freedom, and he wanted to rein in the Chinese communists. Yeah, so he liked George Bush. Most of us disciples thought George W. Bush was I won't say anything, but maybe you get what I mean. You know, it's like you voted for him as president. Yeah. And so they asked, you know, well, you know, Lama voted for George Bush. Do I have to vote for George Bush too? Yeah, okay, now you're learning. No, you don't have to vote for the person you're you know, because your teacher's looking at who to vote for just in terms of how they look at the Tibetan situation. We're looking at it in terms of how they look at governing the country. Yeah. Okay. So we have to ask ourselves, why did we come to the Dharma? Was it to learn politics? Hello? No. Was it to learn about gender discrimination?
No.
Okay. Yeah. Why did we come to the Dharma? We want to learn the path to awakening. Yeah. And it's a free world. We and our teachers can have different opinions about other topics that, you know, like politics, like gender relations, like international relations, like health, you know, and so on. So we came for the Buddha Dharma. So we want a teacher who is competent to teach us whatever level of Buddha Dharma we're at, be it the initial level, learning the refuge and precepts and the Four Noble Truths and so on. Is it to teach us how to get out of samsara? Is it to teach us the bodhisattva path? Yeah. So we came for that reason. And all the other things, yeah. For example, another example, most of my teachers, you know, were from old Tibet. They were raised on Tibetan tea. Yeah. Water, tea, a lot of butter, a lot of salt. Now, some of you may like that, but some of you, like me, may not. And some of you may recognize that when you live at high altitudes, like in Tibet, eating butter and salt makes sense. When you're living at low altitudes, like Singapore, having that kind of diet is going to make you really ill in the long term. But your teacher loves butter tea. Does that mean you have to love butter tea too? No, you didn't come to learn diet. You came to learn the Dharma. Now, some people look at their gurus, look at their teachers, as the way we would look to somebody who we go to for consultation or a therapist or something like that. And so they see it as kind of a transactional relationship. I came to you to learn the teaching, so you teach me, and then I will give you some money. Yeah. If you don't teach what I want to learn, I'm not going to give you any money. Yeah. If you teach me what I want, then I'll give you a lot. Okay. They see it as just like something, like you're purchasing a service in society. Yeah. You give me something, then I give you something. Okay. But first, you have to deliver and give me the goods, then I pay you. I don't pay in advance. Yeah. Yeah. Is this the right attitude to have towards the Buddha Dharma and the path to awakening? No, it's not a commercial enterprise for ourselves or for the teacher. Yeah. So in you people here in Singapore understand that, I think, you know, because many of you were raised in Buddhist families. So you understand that, you know, the teacher teaches freely and people give dana. People make donations. In my country, you know, there's not very many Buddhists. People don't know that. Yeah. And so they often charge for Dharma teachings. Yeah. And then people have this thing, you know, it's like a commercial enterprise. And that's not how we should look at it. You know, we're not paying for a teaching. Yeah. What we're doing is creating merit. Okay. So at Srivasti Abbey, what we do is we have what's called an economy of generosity. Because if this becomes a transactional thing, you know, then it's just a business deal. Who wants to do business with the Dharma? That's not why we're practicing. Yeah. So we don't want that. So economy of generosity means that everybody practices generosity. Okay. So at the Abbey, and I think many places here in Singapore, yeah, the teachings are given freely. When people come to stay at the Abbey, they don't pay. Yeah. We don't charge for meals. We don't charge to pick you up at the airport. Yeah. Some places do. Yeah. But what we had to do is really teach people what an economy of generosity means. You know, it means that everybody takes delight in giving. Yeah. When we take delight in giving, then we create merit. When we just pay, there's no merit. Yeah. It's just an economic service. Like, you know, when you go to have your car tuned up. Yeah. They tune up your car, you pay them. No. What we want to cultivate as Dharma practitioners is people who take delight in giving. Yeah. And so that pertains to the students. It also pertains to the teachers. You know, the teachers want to give freely. Yeah. Not to make money. Yeah. Okay. What else? So we need to also cultivate certain qualities to be a receptive student, okay? One quality is we need to be open-minded, yeah? If we are chock-a-block full with opinions, God exists, I know God exists, I've experienced God, why don't you Buddhists talk about God? Well, you know, is that person going to be open to listening to the teachings? No. Okay. We don't say, get out of here, you're closed-minded. You know? You know, they can come to the teachings, and it's good. They get some seeds planted in their mind. Yeah? So we have to really look at all of our opinions, how we think things should be, you know, because we come into the Dharma with our opinions. Oh, I'll tell you some of mine. I'm a morning person. Yeah, I'm awake in the morning. At nighttime, I'm tired. My energy fades as the day goes on. Some people, you know, they're not, you know, awake in the morning. They're awake at night. Some people are awake all the time. So one of my teachers is that person, awake all the time. Maybe, you know, for an hour, maybe an hour and a half in the middle of the night. He will not lie down. He just sits in meditation position and is silent. Yeah. Me, you know, I like to sleep at night. Yeah. And I function better. Yeah. If I get up early and I, you know, go to bed at a reasonable hour. Well, one of my teachers says, okay, teachings are going to start at 7 this evening. Well, he doesn't have a very good sense of time, you know, or maybe he does. But, you know, 7 o'clock rolls around, and, you know, he's not coming. 7:30, you know, we're all there. And we've studied with this teacher for a long time, so we know that usually things don't start on time. 7:30, no. 9 o'clock, no. 11 o'clock, no. Yeah. Oh, maybe around 11:30, he'll turn up. Yeah. And he doesn't believe in pee-pee breaks. Yeah. Once he starts teaching, you just hold your bladder. Or you run out of the room when you have to. And he will teach, start maybe 11:30 and go to 4 in the morning. Okay. I like getting up maybe around 4:30 in the morning, not going to sleep around 4:30 in the morning. Yeah. This used to drive me totally crazy. Okay. Why can't he start on time? Why can't we have teachings at regular, decent hours where you can go to sleep and get up and feel refreshed? You know, forget it. You know, he has his way of doing things. Yeah. And if I want the teachings, I'd better go. Yeah, some of you know who I'm talking about. Yeah. So this is just the way it is. So you have to have an open mind, just even about, you know, scheduling things. Yeah, but an open mind to hearing about the Dharma, because the Dharma is going to go against so many of our ordinary views, so many things that society believes in, so many things that our parents have taught us. Yeah? What does society say is success? Money and a corner office, and a car to match, and a spouse to match. Yeah, and to be young and beautiful always, you know, complete with Botox. Okay, that's what society tells you is success. Does Dharma tell you that's success? Uh-uh. What's success? Generosity, not accumulating wealth yourself. Being generous to other people. Yeah. Not caring about status. Realizing that your job status is no indication of your worth as a human being. Your social status is no indication of your worth as a being. Even your educational status does not mean that you're intelligent. Because you can be intelligent and no rocket science, but when it comes to the Dharma, your mind is like, you know, totally closed. So, you know, what you value as good characteristics of a Dharma practitioner are not necessarily what the ones that we have been schooled in and that we have internalized. Yeah. So, you know, in the Dharma practice, we have to look at all these kind of values and opinions that we have internalized and see if they correspond with what the Buddha taught. Okay. So I'm not talking about politics here. We take our values and apply them to all everything in our life, okay? So, for example, with me, I can talk freely here, not about the Singapore government, about the American government and our wonderful, fantastic, the best president we've ever had. He even tells us that he's the best president that that the country has ever had, yeah? But when I apply Dharma values of compassion, Dharma values of generosity, yeah, the Orange King doesn't fit the bill. Yeah. So it's okay we have different opinions there. But if, let's say, I was somebody who came along and I said, yeah, he's right. We've got to get all the migrants out of the country. They're all rapists and criminals. This is what he says. This is a direct quote. They're rapists. They're criminals. They're polluting the blood of the country. Get them out. Let's say I'm somebody who has that opinion. I agree with the president of the country and the people who voted for him. But I come to the Dharma, yeah, and the Dharma's talking about kindness. Yeah, in the Bodhisattva vows, we're supposed to help the impoverished. We're supposed to help travelers. Yeah, generosity creates wealth. Fortitude and tolerance is a virtue. Yeah. So, you know, if I believe in the same political opinions, but then I'm learning the Dharma, there's going to be something like this. So I have to be open enough to hear the Dharma and to take it in and to think about it. Yeah. Okay. One of my dreams is to give a Dharma talk to the U.S. Congress. I think they really need it. Yeah. But probably if I ever get that possibility, which I don't think I will, but if I do, most of them may walk out. Yeah. There's some, Nancy Pelosi, you know, there's some who love His Holiness. Yeah, they'll stay. But there's a few. That's okay. You know, you plant seeds in people's minds. Okay, so as disciples, we need to be open to hearing things that don't jive with what our family believes, with what society tells us, okay? We also need to be intelligent. This doesn't mean rocket science intelligence. It means intelligent regarding the Dharma. And they're two different things. In other words, whatever our teachers teach, we need to question it and to be intelligent in questioning it, so that we make the teachings our own. We don't just have blind belief. Oh, Guru said that, His Holiness said that, I believe. No, His Holiness doesn't like that. In fact, he tells a story. I'm going to mention Singapore here, because this is what he said. It happened many years ago, so I think many of you weren't around. Yeah. But he said he went to, this was in the years when he could come to Singapore. So he came to Singapore, he gave a teaching, and he just had the feeling like people just said, okay, he's a high lama, I believe. Yeah, kind of blind faith. And he said, Buddhism is not about blind faith. It's about listening to the teachings and thinking about them, questioning them, investigating them. And that's why in the monasteries they debate. Yeah. And that's why we should discuss the teachings with our Dharma friends. We should ask questions. Repeat. We should ask questions. Singaporeans, when I say, anybody have question? No. No. Why don't you have questions? I know you have questions because you line up after the talk to ask your question. But you will not ask the question in front of the group. Oh, why not? little bit of attachment to reputation, maybe. Yeah. But actually, when you ask a question, you are helping everybody else in the group because chances are many of them have the same question. Yeah. Okay. So we need to be intelligent, open-minded, intelligent. The third quality, we need to be sincere. We need to really, to be a good disciple, an open-minded disciple who's going to get somewhere, we need to be sincere. Yeah, we want to learn the Dharma. We want to subdue our afflictions. We want to generate virtuous qualities. Yeah. So we come to the Dharma. We're not looking for praise. Yeah. We're looking for teachings and that we sincerely can question and apply to our lives so that we can be better human beings and make a positive contribution to the country and to society. Yeah. So sincerity, we're not learning the Dharma so that we can be a teacher and sit on a high throne. Okay? We call those teachers charlatananda. Yeah. Charlatan Ananda. Yeah. They're charlatans. But we want to learn the Dharma so that we can, you know, be a teacher and have one of those very modest offering bowls, you know. Okay. No, we have to be sincere and really have some feeling for what samsara is and want to get out of it and have some feeling how everybody is just like us, wanting happiness and not suffering. And so being willing to start to consider that other people's feelings and needs are important. Okay. So that's a little bit about relying. Oh, there's another thing. Yeah, this comes in the long run. How do you rely on your teacher? Okay, so you rely on them in your mind, yeah, by having faith, but not blind faith. Faith that is based on knowing their qualities. Yeah, so you rely on them that way. You show respect and so on. And you rely on them also through your actions. Yeah. So how do you rely on them through your actions? Well, we help them materially. Yeah. Because our teachers need to eat. Yeah. And you don't, in Singapore, you don't want them sitting at the MRT station. Yeah. You know. And maybe in other cultures that happens. In Singapore, I don't think it would go over very well. Yeah. So you provide them with the requisites, food, clothing, shelter, medicine. Yeah. And by keeping them alive, they can teach and help sentient beings. The second thing that we do to show through our actions is we help them with their projects. Okay. So you do what we call at the office offering service. Yeah. And our teachers usually have projects. Yeah. Maybe they're helping their monastery. Yeah. And you know that there's a real monastery that they're helping. Yeah. Or they're setting up a school in an area of India where there's lots of refugee Tibetans, where there's Indian kids who need a good education. They're setting up a school or they're setting up a clinic. Yeah. So our teachers always have some kind of project of what they're doing. Yeah. So we help them. Yeah. Because if they have to do everything in their projects, they're not going to have any time to teach. Yeah. And then what's the third one? I spaced out. What? I can't hear you. Yes, thank you. Well, funny that that's the one I forgot. Yeah, we're supposed to practice according to their advice. So, you know, when the teachers give us Dharma advice, we listen, we practice. We don't, you know, I'm telling you more things, the kind of questions I get. You know, I really like Chenrezig practice and I like color chakra practice. Can I do the Chenrezig practice but visualize color chakra? No. Yeah. Chenrezig has 1,000 arms. Yeah. Can I visualize fewer? Or, you know, he's standing up with 1,000 arms. He needs to sit down. Can I visualize Chenrezig sitting down? You know, and instead of visualizing him as white, you know, my favorite color is blue. So can Chenrezig be blue? Yeah. No. Okay. Our teacher tells us, you know, you go with a problem and your teacher gives you advice. And how do you respond? These two will tell you. How do people respond? Two words.
Yes,
but. Yes, but.
Straight no.
Yeah, or a straight no. Either, you know, they give you advice how to deal with your problem. No. Or yes, but, and then they tell you why they can't do it. And then they ask you again for advice. And what can you say? Please repeat to me what I just told you. Yeah, you didn't even hear it. Because as soon as they gave you some advice that you didn't want, boom. Yeah. So we should really listen and take the advice to heart. No. Yeah. When you, and do not flood your teacher with all sorts of things, like I told you, you know, where should I have a problem with my landlord, where do I go? Yeah. And, this is a real great question. In Malaysia one time, some years ago, one student came and said, I've been dating this one guy, should I marry him? How am I supposed to know? Well, you know, I asked one Lama before and he said I should marry him. I asked the next Lama who came, he said I shouldn't marry him. Yeah. What do you think? Should I marry him? Okay. I have compassion for the poor guy. No. No, I didn't. I mean, how can I give somebody advice about who to marry? Come on. Yeah. You decide those kind of things. if you are having problems, don't ask me, should I divorce them? Okay. Ask me, how do I control my own anger? We're having marital problems. I'm angry. I'm upset. How do I control my anger? Don't ask me whether you should divorce the guy. Don't tell me he's not making enough money. and how can you nudge him to make more money? I told that woman, look, you got a really nice, I knew the guy that she was married to for many years. I said, you have a very nice ethical husband. It doesn't matter how much money he makes. Okay. So, you know, when you ask questions, be willing to hear the answer. Yeah. Yes, but is not a proper response. If you don't want to know the answer because you already know what answer you want the teacher to give, don't ask the question. I had one young man come and ask me, should I ordain? Can I ordain? Yeah. Well, he had been at the Abbey. I knew him for some time. He had some issues to work out. I said, you need to wait. Yeah, you're young. You need to wait. These are the issues you need to work out before you ordain. Well, he didn't like that answer. So he went to Dharamsala. So then he asked that, he went to see that lama, you know, and maybe, I don't know. He went to see many lamas. He asked each of them, should he ordain? Some said yes. Some said wait. Some said, I don't know, do you want another cup of tea? Yeah. Finally, one teacher said, well, it just happens. I'm giving ordination in a couple of days. Get your robes and come and I'll ordain you. Okay. This is after asking many people. Yeah. And then he ordained and then he contacted me and said, I'm ordained. And he still hadn't worked out those issues. Then some time went by and he calls me and he says, I'm having a problem with my attachment. Can you give me some advice? Well, this was the advice that I gave him before he ordained and why I told him to wait. But he wanted to go from one teacher to the next until he heard what he wanted to hear. Yeah, that's, don't be like that because, yeah, you're not looking for the teacher to give you a stamp of approval. You're looking for them to give you some advice. Yeah, and you can discuss the advice that they give you with them, yeah, but first think about it, yeah. Don't just say, oh, but I want to ordain and he told me no. No, why did he say no? Yeah, okay. So really think, about what your teacher says and think about what you really want to ask. Yeah, what is your real question? I'll give you a tip. Your teacher, usually the Tibetan teachers, Western teachers are different, but Tibetan teachers, usually they are not interested in your life story. Okay. Oh, I was born and I was, you know, the eldest. And so I had to take care of all the younger siblings and I had to go to work early and I was a girl, but they all wanted a boy. And then this happened and that happened. And then I went to work and you know, people took advantage of me at work and I had this lousy boss who fired me and nobody treats me fairly. And, you know, my life is just a mess. Like, what do I do? You know, that's not the question. Yeah. If you want to talk about your life story, yeah, go to a therapist, go to a counselor, okay? That's somebody who is educated to listen, yeah? And you don't have to give your life story and speak for 3 years, you know. They will ask you questions and you answer them. Yeah. Western teachers are a little bit more open to hearing life stories. But again, sometimes a shorter version. Because sometimes, you know, I've seen people go in to see a lama and they're there for like 4 or 5 hours with their life story. And somebody kind of has to go in and say, you know, oh, yeah. So, yeah. So be practical. Yeah. Okay. So it's 1 minute past 12. I know you have no questions. But, you know, I'm supposed to ask, do you have questions? Please ask questions. And don't line up afterwards to ask your question individually. This is your chance.
If the teacher has passed away, how does she raise?
Okay. And so somebody's...
In the Tibetan tradition, there's a reincarnation.
Yeah.
And as I understand, not to think that the new reincarnation is... I shouldn't think that this person is the previous one. So I'm not sure.
Yeah. Okay, so if our teacher passes away, some people just say, oh, my teacher's not here, I can't practice anymore. That's not the correct attitude, okay? Because when the teacher gave us the teachings, yeah, the teachings didn't pass away. The teachings are there. We still need to practice. We should not think, oh, my teacher died, my Dharma practice is ruined, I have no inspiration. No, this is the time when you really have to step up to the plate and practice and share the Dharma with other people. Yeah. Regarding the reincarnation thing, this is a Tibetan cultural, something in Tibetan culture. The other cultures don't do this. Initially, it was a way to pass down property because well-respected teachers usually get a lot of offerings. When they die, then how do you pass on the offerings? Oh, to the reincarnation. It's also a way so that if they can identify accurately the reincarnation, then you can give these children a special education so they can grow up again to be very excellent masters. So that makes sense, yeah. What people often do, though, us ordinary people, is like, oh, he died, my practice is gone, yeah. Oh, he was reborn, oh, I've got to go see, yeah. I remember when we, Lama Yeshe, the incarnation of Lama Yeshe, he was about 2 years old. You know, he was really maybe three, and he came to Singapore. Mm. Yeah. And I was living in Singapore at that time. So I was in charge of setting things up for him. Yeah. So he's a three-year-old. Yeah. So we brought him, you know, I was living at a temple with an old folks home, and we brought him there, and, you know, he sat on a table so that everybody could see him. You know, what do 2-year-olds do? What do 3-year-olds do? They squirm. Yeah, maybe they suck their thumb. They look around at all sorts of things. So here he is. And the people look at him and like, oh, look, he smiled. Look, he waved his hand. Look, he's eating some chocolate. Yeah. No. Or, yeah, like I remember when I went to see him the first, no, not him, one of my other teachers, the incarnation, the first time, I came out and people said, did he recognize you? What? He's going to recognize me? He has hundreds, probably of over 1,000 disciples. You know, I was there in the early years. He knew me. But I don't expect a child to look at me and say, oh, hi, you're Tupten Chodron, the one who chanted to my dogs. No. Yeah. And also, you know, you don't automatically accept the incarnation of your teacher as your teacher. Yeah, they have to be trained. They have to be educated again. Yeah. So you see how they grow up. Yeah. And then you check them out again and see if they're a good teacher.
My name is Patrick. Thank you, Venerable, for your talk. I find it sometimes difficult to differentiate actual teachings from the culture. A lot of times, culture plays a strong part in how the teachings are transmitted. Yep. And how a student should follow the teacher accordingly, yep. Even though you're advised to be open-minded. Yep. I shared this experience when I was a Shaman era. I was ordained as a novice monk for 3 months in a Taiwanese monastery. I could have gone for my other ordination, but the cultural aspects is just too overwhelming for me as a Singaporean person, who is like, has a bit of Western culture and a bit of Chinese culture.
Yeah.
So how can we be rooted in the Dharma and not be affected by the cultural practices, especially in the Chinese Buddhism kind of thing?
Okay. Yeah, this is a very good question. Yeah. And I think we all, you know, do that. My first ordination was in the Tibetan tradition. They don't have the lineage for full ordination for women. So I took my full ordination in the Chinese tradition. I was like, going, wow, you know, this is really different. I had just mastered sitting down for hours. Chinese monasteries, you stand up for hours. Yeah. And the robes, you wear so many robes and you're so hot and you're sweaty, you know? So there's a lot of these kinds of differences. So some of the differences, you have to assess how big of a difference it is, okay? Wearing the Chinese robes, they were too hot for me, but you have to give up some things. You can't just go in and say, you know, I want to wear what I want to wear because that's how I'm comfortable. Okay? So there's some things that you have to give up. And there's a certain etiquette that you have to learn, yeah, which is different than regular etiquette. Yeah. So there's certain things you know, you have to be willing to learn those things. There's other things that are very much culture, yeah? And it makes sense to the people from that culture, but as an outsider, it doesn't really fit with us, yeah? So I think that, you know, we need to adapt how the Dharma is taught and so on to our own culture. Yeah, we need to learn from our teachers, yeah, and they very often may be from a different culture, but then we need to adapt it to our own culture, okay? So, for example, you know, when I started out, everything was in Tibetan, yeah, and we did all of our practices in Tibetan. Didn't matter, we didn't understand Tibetan. Who cares? You know, from the viewpoint of our teachers, first of all, there was hardly any English translation then, and especially of the practices, the pujas and so on. You know, they do them in Tibetan and they wanted us to learn. So I did them in Tibetan. Then when I was sent to Singapore to teach, this was in the 80s, yeah. Then I remember one day I was teaching people the Chenrezig practice, yeah. We were chanting it in Tibetan, okay. And then all of a sudden I went, wait a minute. Everybody I'm teaching this to is Singaporean. They don't know Tibetan. I don't know Tibetan. Why are we doing this in Tibetan? Especially when His Holiness says we should do our practices in our own language so we understand what we're saying. So that was like, boom, a big light bulb for me. Now, of course, whenever I went to the centers where my teachers are from, you know, and when they were there, of course, it was all in Tibetan. Yeah. But when I explain the practices to people, you know, who don't know Tibetan, I talk in English. Yeah. So it's a process of adapting things. You know, the Tibetans, all the different horns and things like that. His Holiness says, you can use a guitar, you can use a piano, you know, you can use Chinese instruments if you want to. It's a music offering. It doesn't matter what it is, what plays the music. Okay. The tormas, we don't need, you know, to like, where do you get sampa in Singapore? You know, ground barley flour. And how do you, you know, you have to knead it and make it these weird shapes. You don't know what it means, and make butter sculptures. And the butter sculptures are great in Singapore. Yeah, they melt. The minute you don't even need to finish making them for them to melt. Yeah. So, you know, we adapt it. You take a can of fruit, you wrap it in pretty paper, yeah, and you put some things on it, and that's your torma. Doesn't have to be made of with sampa. Yeah, because the tormas were initially made in India, and they didn't have sampa there. Yeah, katas is a Tibetan invention. In ancient India, they offered flowers. Yeah, Tibet, high altitude, not so many flowers. You offer scarves. Okay. It so happens, I think people here, and I know in my country, people like katas. Yeah, after they do it the first time. The first time it's like, I'm giving somebody a scarf and they're giving it back to me. And I'm supposed to hold the scarf with the open end towards them. What? Why? You know, well, so that you're open to the teachings. But they don't tell you that the first time. Yeah. And how do I fold a scarf? You know, in the old days, when I turned up in Dharamsala, we had these really cheap scarves. Nobody could afford the nice scarves. You know, the Tibetans were refugees. We were poor hippies. So you got these thin kind of gauzy scarves, you know, katas, and you rolled them, you know, doing them accordion style. They weren't very long. The katas were maybe this long. Accordion style's not difficult. Now there's silk or you know, some kind of slippery material, soft slippery material for your katas. Yeah? How does it work to fold them accordion style? Can you do that? First of all, the katas are really long. So you stand here, someone in the back of the room holds the other end, you know, and then you're going like this to fold the kata. You get to the end, and what do you do with an accordion folded kata when you hold it? It falls apart. All the fleets come out, don't they? And you're back where you started, and you need to fold it again. So I'm a practical person. I just fold it in half and fold it in half again. That's good enough. You know, you just fold it in half. That way it doesn't fall apart. You know, as long as I get it open so that I can offer it to the teachers, that's good enough. Okay. So does that answer your question okay?
So my question is that is regarding how do you the question of evaluating the actions of the teacher. So then you say that not everything a teacher does you have to follow, right? I mean, it's just you might get a preference sometimes, but when it comes to the Dharma, like learning the Buddha Dharma, there's some stuff that not that clear cut. Like certain actions that teachers do are based upon their understanding of the Buddha Dharma. So how then do we separate some actions as you should learn that or you should not learn that? Is it based on our own understanding of the intentions of the teacher?
Can you give me an example?
I'm not too sure if this is a good example, for example. Like, I think it is the case that for Lama Sui Parabrijin last time, he used to leave out some food for like some of the ants or animals that pass by or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So in our perspective, it might be like, when we first see it, we might think that, what's the point of that? It might attract more pests, it might attract insects that we don't want, right? Then we might form those impressions. Then we think that, hey, this is something that we shouldn't follow, we think it's bad, right? How then do we separate like this kind of
interpretations? I'm going to give my opinion, yeah? If my teacher wants to leave out food for the ants, that's great. That's fine. I hope he does it somewhere not inside the building. Yeah. If he does it inside the building and the ants come, I'm sure he would understand if I explained that this was not so healthy. And in fact, it endangers the ants because they're going to get stepped on and squashed. Okay? You know, if he wants to do some practices that I don't understand, that's okay. You know, he did a practice of offering water to the hungry ghosts, you know, where you have a hat with strings on in front of it so that you don't scare the hungry ghosts away when they see you, and then you pour water. That's great. I mean, Rinpoche, I'm sure he saw the hungry ghost. Me? I'm a hungry ghost. Yeah. And I want this and I want that and I want the other thing. I have to tame my own hungry ghostism. Yeah. I don't do that practice, but I try and be generous to charities, especially for refugees, especially for people who are poor. Yeah, I try and, you know, share food there. We give food to the turkeys where we live. Actually, we do the preta offering at the end of our meals, you know, where you say the mantra and throw it and say some prayers. And we collect the preta offerings. We take them outside. We have a place where we put them. The turkeys are usually waiting there. They know it's lunchtime. And, you know, we make offering to the pretas, but the turkeys get it. Okay? What else? Yeah. So things like that, you can adapt it to your own culture in a way that makes sense for you to practice. Yeah. You know, Rinpoche used to stop every time there was a roadkill. He would stop and do prayers for the animal and then an hour later go to where he was supposed to be. That is his style. You know, that is his style, his personal way of doing things. when I see dead animals along the way, I stop, I say some mantra, and I blow on them. And I tell them to have a precious human life and be born in the Pure Land. I don't do it for an hour. I did it this morning, maybe 2 or 3 minutes. Yeah, not so long. So, you know, you can adapt it to your culture.
Thank you very much for that answer. Just a small, maybe like follow-up question. Earlier you also mentioned that how you should evaluate teachers based on the ethics, the concentration as well as the wisdom of the teacher, right? What about if there are certain cases, for example, the legendary story of like Tilopa and Naropa? So in that case, you might not always see like regular ethical conduct. So yeah. How then do you look at such relationships?
Okay, His Holiness says, okay. Well, okay, so one example is Tilopa told Naropa to jump off a cliff. Yeah, he said, if you're a good disciple, you're going to jump off the cliff. Now, you know, Tilopa was a very accomplished meditator and yogi. Naropa was a very well-educated geshe. He knew the Dharma very well, okay? This doesn't mean that if your teacher tells you to jump off a cliff, that you look for the nearest cliff. Yeah. Singapore, there aren't so many cliffs. Yeah, you can come to my country. There's lots of cliffs. Yeah. His Holiness says, if, the key word here is, if your teacher has the quality of Tilopa and you have the qualities of Naropa, then you can jump off the cliff. But if your teacher does not have the same qualities as Tilopa and you don't have the qualities of Naropa, you're not a geshe, you don't know the Dharma inside and out, then not such a good idea to jump off the cliff. Okay? Okay, so we have to use our wisdom. Yeah. I could tell you many more stories about this, but I will spare you. Because we are approaching the best time of the day. Lunch. Okay. And I've already gone almost a half an hour too long. So.
Thank you, level two. Level one, any final question?
What's for lunch? That's what they're asking. Okay. So we're going to dedicate.
Due to this man,
Mary's born in the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. One more final comment. You have a very good teacher here. Yeah. Learn from him. Respect him well. Follow his instructions. Yeah. If he wants to do pujas in Tibetan, when you're with him, do pujas in Tibetan. Yeah. But study the puja yourself. And when you do it at home, you know, or with your friends here, do it in English or Chinese or Swahili, whatever, you know, language you want. Okay?